Okay, this is session number 52, being recorded on September 23rd, 2007. This is Side A, and we're looking at the Bob Dobbs formula chart, and Scott is going to be the bridge from the last session to this one.
Yeah.
And so what was it that you were talking about you mentioned?
Well, anyone that's been with us so far probably recognizes a bit of the form of the chart itself in terms of the fact that we covered Washington, Jefferson, and Lincoln so far, and that they are holding the status quo for culture. They're using the manufacturer's printed book and oratory to stave off the onslaught of effects of the usury slash monarchy, newspaper and telegraph.
Newer media.
Yeah, the newer media, which are threatening the consensus reality and causing a sense of impending doom or upset of the old form. And that at a deeper level, then we have the one-half stage and the other one-half stage, which is the new media that's being developed, which is coming into incarnation, telegraph, movies, and radio, and are being, intuited by the other one-half stage, lockdown centralization, lockdown industrial government, lockdown electrical government. These are being intuited sort of by the intelligence agencies, which are informing the Washington, Jefferson, and Lincoln figures about how to cope with the fact that there's a war going on between technological cultural enemy and technological weaponry.
Right. So just to rehash that in my terms, you have the deep ground of the telegraph, movies, and radio under the ALP far left column, which is totally not recognized by anybody. But the ground, the hidden ground that is recognized, and the population may not be aware of, but the intelligence agencies and the president and those in the know of authority and have to keep abreast of what's going on just to protect their own society, they are picking up on the ground for them, which is manufacturers, print a book, and oratory. It's like a semi-conscious ground, half conscious, so they know they're working with manufacturers, or in the later phase, print a book and oratory. Those are given media that the population is engaged in, but may not understand the full effects of them, but the intelligence agencies listed under HCE, which can be just professors, scientists, artists, soldiers, military, people who are smart, or the elites of the society that day. They can see what's really going on more than the average citizen can, and they see also threats to that situation, perceived threats. So the perceived threats are under the SHEM column, which is called technological slash cultural enemy. And they're usually new hidden grounds that are starting to be visible and threaten the semi-hidden ground. But both of them, the SHEM and the SHON columns, and Washington and the politicians are under ISI, and the intelligence agencies are under HCE on the far right, all of them are being affected by a deeper ground under ALP on the far left that nobody's aware of. Though, since children are sensitive, they are picking up the sensitivities that the parents are concerned about, and they may be a guide, like anthropologists said in primitive tribes, that the elders always looked at the young kids, see what they're doing, because it kind of expressed instinctively hidden factors that were going on in the society. So it was a good barometer. So with that idea, the HCE gang are looking at SHEM, SHON, and ISI, or particularly SHEM and SHON column, SHEM being technological slash cultural enemy, SHON being technological slash weaponry, watching the tensions between them and figuring out and preserving their power in relationship to that. And the power usually is represented in America by the president. So the ISI presidential column is called anthropomorphic sociological slash psychological mask or lag. Lag meaning that it isn't the full ground under ALP, but it is certain levels of tensions and pressures that are happening that they can perceive that the average citizen probably can't see or perceive, so that they're dealing with the far-right intelligence agency, are dealing with the causes merging with effects. So the causes, in quotes, they're not the deepest causes, which are on the far left. The causes on the right are merging with the effects, so that Shem and Sean are causes that have merged with the effects of manufacturers versus usury monarchy, printed book versus newspaper, oratory versus telegraph. One could say that those effects are influenced by deeper effects, the effects preceding causes. Now note, causes under ALP is not in quotes, and the causes that are in under HCE are, is in quotes. They're the figures, the ones under HCE. So Shem, Sean, and Issy are the figures or the actors in the global theater, and they're often retrievals and interiorization. Interiorization means that something that was a hidden ground is starting to be recognized. It's not so hidden anymore. That's interiorization. That's a process of recognition. For example, when the electric environment really gets going in the first part of the 20th century, all the new avant-garde art movements start looking at the machine as an art form. So the previous hidden ground of the machine, hidden ground in terms of its effects, is now being starting to be interiorized by the more perceptive part of the population. It's beginning to be seen and so presented. And the art looks pretty ugly, stark, new, bizarre, even though it's talking about a previous ground. All right? And it, that art, is responding to a deeper ground, the electronic effect.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, we've been through this before. Previous environment becomes art form as it's subsumed by a newer hidden environment.
So this chart begins with the effects of the electronic environment creeping up on 4,000 years of human history, where we had agricultural and animal husbandry, and then mechanical and even industrial mechanical. And then this chart begins when the electrical begins to reconfigure all of that.
Yeah, what we could call the information society, the information revolution. These collective mass media forms that are the new forms of culture.
Mm-hmm.
So they're a threat to the hardware situation, which is the manufacturers. They're a threat to the printed book or the newspaper or usury and the monarchy. So as they, usury, monarchy, manufacturers, and later printed book, newspaper, fight among themselves, they're jockeying for position because there's some other thing sneaking up on them, and they can feel it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and they, so you're talking about, when you say they can feel it, you're talking about the technology itself is feeling the stress of the new technology, and the human beings are also feeling the stress.
Right, and that's why under ISI and HCE, well, especially ISI, that's the anthropomorphic human being perception of what they think is happening.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
HCE represents that too, because they're the bureaucratic ground, but they are talking about under HCE lockdown, centralization, lockdown, industrial government. You could say ISI and HCE are kind of the anthropomorphic effects. What humans think they're doing. Humans are hierarchical, bureaucratic, and they try to implement that kind of social norm that's been all through history. But they're inside a new electric effect that sort of threatens hierarchy because it's sort of, quote, democratic. Starts creating global ESP.
Right.
That everybody has access to.
Yeah. But Washington, Jefferson, and Lincoln, in terms of their oratory capacity, are not trying to, persuade human beings to their point of view based on
technology. No, they are. They are trying to persuade people to the values of their culture.
To the humanistic values, but not the technological values.
Well, they might see, why did the 18th, 19th century become very keen on what was called progress? They identified with the technological hardware that was being invented. They thought it was smart to move forward. Now, Jefferson tended to favor the agricultural vision, whereas Hamilton wanted to adopt the new industrial situation. That's why LaRouche is pro-Hamilton, anti-Jefferson. That's an ongoing battle in American history. The agricultural tendency, you could say semi-Luddite, stay in the agrarian level and not get involved with industrialized cities. But the hidden ground is, that's what lockdown centralization means, that the effects of industrial technology are going to become inevitable because a new ground, telegraph, is forcing people to recognize the old ground and kind of take it as a given. And they actually, they knew about what the effects of the telegraph were, that then they might actually justify it, the Luddite Jeffersonian tendency, and destroy it.
Mm-hmm.
But they don't, because they're competing with the other gang that says, well, we don't know, we don't believe the disservices override the services of new technological developments. And these are countries that are trying to develop themselves just to preserve their culture and protect it. So they want to have the latest weaponry. So that's why under Sean, his technological inventions are kind of like weaponry.
Do you happen to know what countries actually had access or were developing telegraph communication between 1840 and 1900?
Well, the first was United States. They developed it in the first telegraph is like somewhere between Baltimore and Washington, something like that, if I remember, and that's in the 1840s or 1850s. But Europe is catching up pretty quickly. But I think it's developed mainly in America first.
Mm-hmm.
That's the famous heroism of Samuel Morse.
Yeah.
Who I just heard recently, LaRue says that's a total fraud that Samuel Morse invented telegraph. He ripped it off some other guy, Joseph somebody. And so he says the whole controversy over Morse as taking the credit for the telegraph. But the point is it was invented in America. I'm assuming
This then establishes the trend that America will become the
fountain of virtual society.
Yeah.
Virtual reality. It's the beginning of virtual reality.
Yeah. Whereas other nations, even up until the present day, will be fighting. I just saw something on TV this morning about the 10 top, tyrants who run countries around the world. And so there are still countries that are run by, basically egomaniac tyrants who are trying to establish among the people of their country that they are the end all and be all of culture. And
they want to lock down centralization around their anthropomorphic projection.
Right.
And it usually includes the cultural. They put on the images of the culture, the sociological and psychological mask or lag, because they are trying to defend a culture in relation to the American virtual reality, which wipes out all known cultures.
Mm-hmm. Wipes out the anthropomorphic mass.
Well, the anthropomorphic is each culture's perception of what they think they are representing.
Yeah.
So, yeah, the Americans think that their culture, their virtual reality, is what we are. So that's their anthropomorphic projection. And they are competing with other cultures' anthropomorphic projection.
Mm-hmm.
But it gets really confused when the cultures are subsumed by the American virtual reality technologies, which create whole new subcultures or new kinds of cultures.
Right.
So that the culture that a primitive third world nation is trying to preserve is not really there.
Yeah. So
it's a lag. See, that's the mass. That's the lag. They have to believe it's still there.
Right. And so the android mean, do you still agree, or was this a past phenomena? The android mean is represented by the White House.
You asking me if I still agree?
Yeah.
Have
we gone beyond that, or is the android mean still represented by the White House?
The android meme is represented by the White House. But what is the image of the White House the last 5-7 years? Somebody who can't communicate.
Mm-hmm.
So there's... It reflects the fact that the android meme has stepped aside and made people think that they're in control. All right? That's the seductive part.
Made people think that the android meme's in that the White House is in control.
No. When we move from voluntary when we move from cloned ESP, analog one-way media, electric media, to voluntary ESP, where people can disconnect and have media consumption that, with more friendly digital technologies that you can use at your own time, and you don't have to watch a mass-produced show that everybody has to do at one time.
Mm-hmm.
So the Android meme is saying, you're in charge. I've said this, gone over this many times. So if you're in charge, any figures of authority will not have any charisma.
Mm.
They must put on the image that we represent you and you're in charge and tell us what to do.
Right.
We'll do some polling of you.
Does the Android...
So let me finish this. Okay, no, this is, okay, now, when the Android meme has got to the point where it cannot appear to be controlling, then the White House has to have a charismatic national image. So what is it going to be? It's going to communicate an indifference to centralized media, which was the analog phase of the Android meme. And it does that by presenting an image of a person who doesn't read the newspapers, doesn't watch TV, can't finish a sentence, and is not interested in communicating. That, ironically, is charismatic in the first part of this recent decade because people are out there feeling, we don't want to hear from centralized media, and we're going to vote for this guy because he's a regular guy and he's not involved with the centralized media. Now, that's a charismatic image created by the Android meme, a subtle seduction.
Mm-hmm.
You see?
Yeah. Is it created by the Android meme, or is it recognized by savvy human beings who know how to take advantage of the situation?
Well, it's an ongoing question where our consciousness ends and the Android meme begins.
Mm-hmm.
That's a problem.
Right.
But McLuhan pointed out, first of all, recognize that your consciousness may be made up of the environment more than you realize.
Yeah.
Especially if you're a literate person in the West who believes there's a split between your mind and your body, and you're detached, you may not believe that you were affected by new technologies that create environments.
Yeah.
So it gets really intricate and tricky, and that's why Finnegan's Wake is a good expression of that, because you have this basic five-member family structure, but as you read Finnegan's Wake, Shem becomes Sean, Sean becomes Issy becomes Shem, ALP becomes AC, it's all mixed up. It's totally multi-leveled incestuous, and they also are machines. So the blurring is incredible.
Does this imply that Joyce in the 1920s and 30s recognized he was able to project the development and subsequent dissolution of the Android meme?
I don't know if he projected the dissolution. But he definitely saw the virtual reality taking over with the help of Wyndham Lewis.
Mm-hmm.
But Wyndham Lewis and what's called the Men of 1914, Wyndham Lewis, Joyce, Eliot, and Ezra Pound, they built on the symbolists and advances in culture in the 19th century. So that's the history that McLuhan lays out. He shows who led one to who, you know, who led the next guy.
And they make Orwell look ignorant or puny. Is
yeah.
that correct?
That's what McLuhan's view is, yeah.
Yeah.
But the...
I just saw a movie called Other People's Lives. It begins 2 years before the fall of the Berlin Wall. East Berlin was a communist, is that correct?
Yeah.
West Berlin was free. So it takes place in East Berlin, and it's the intelligence agency, and they're doing surveillance on the people who are considered to be influential artists in the culture. And what they do is they go in when the artists aren't there, and they bug their homes with... microphones and even to some degree
I read a review of this very complex movie.
Yeah, and so they and the 24 hours they're listening in on their conversations to see if these people are thinking, if these artists are thinking about anything that would be threatening to the status quo political powers.
Yeah.
And if they are, then they go in and basically destroy these people before they have a chance to propagate their art, their movies or books or whatever kind of art that they want to proliferate in an effort to create pre-thinking and liberation among human beings. Then when the wall falls, would that be '87 or
November '89?
'89. After the wall falls, all of a sudden, now all of the CIA, but secret intelligence portfolios and dossiers that had been collected on all of these artists, Now they have a Freedom of Information Act, and these artists are actually allowed to go back to the archives and find out what these case histories that had been developed while they were being surveilled, actually what the report, they're actually able to look at the reports. And so there's a tremendous freedom and liberation of information. What's going on with the Android meme at this time that allows this fall of the Berlin Wall to occur?
Well, that's a long story. I don't want to get too distracted, but my charts are dealing with that. Maybe we might have to come back to that later. But the main point is that the authorities in East Berlin, the communist authorities, are worried about messages, and they're surveilling these people who are going to put out messages that they think are subversive. Whereas in the United States, from Andy Warhol on, 60s, 70s, 80s, before the Berlin Wall went down, there's all kinds of free alternative cultures forming, and there's no Big Brother stopping people. There's a certain level of surveillance of some political actions, like the people trying to take out, help people in the 80s come from Central America, and the death squad problems down there and all that. There was the FBI and the CIA are doing their political stuff, but it's marginalized. It's only one side. The majority of the population is involved with all kinds of revolutions through pop culture. So that, the puny thing of surveilling someone putting out an image is a 19th century situation in a backward culture like East Berlin.
But pop culture becomes the hypnosis which imprisons culture, which imprisons free thinking.
You recommended a movie.
Now
follow this, hold it. You don't suppress the ideas when pop culture is hypnotism. You encourage radical ideas.
Yeah.
Postmodernists, but here they are in this movie talking about people suppressing radical ideas. That's Orwellian. That's dealing with the 19th century.
Yeah. But the artists who wanted to be able to become purveyors of radical new ideas, in many cases like Warhol, actually failed to help us out in the long run. I mean, you recommended a movie called The Net, and The Unabomber. And there's an interesting commentary in there by a guy named Paul Guerin. And he talks about the fact that he says that, he agrees with McLuhan that information, that advertising is information warfare and perception, and that the news media basically is perception management. And that instead of 5 minutes, everybody getting 5 minutes of fame, he says, how about everybody getting 5 minutes of truth? And when I heard that, I recognized the fact that Warhol was, as much as I wanted to sort of idolize him as being, a pop cultural hero, he was perpetuating the fucking brainwashing conspiracy
Exactly. And McLuhan critiqued Warhol in his book, Through the Vanishing Point. He said Warhol was merging with the new electronic effects, mm-hmm. celebrating them, doing tribal art. McLuhan recommended detachment and not being swallowed up by pop art. And when Ted Carpenter had a party around 1973, McLuhan comes to New York and he goes to the party, and there's Kurt Vonnegut and Andy Warhol, might have been someone else, but Ted Carpenter tells the story that when Warhol's pointed out to McLuhan, he says rudely, quite loud voice, says, that hick? That rube? And so he puts down Warhol as a naive country bumpkin. And then Carpenter says, and there's Kurt Vonnegut. He says, oh, I can't stand his writing, says McLuhan. So Carpenter says he has to change the seating order at the dinner table because McLuhan is so rude. But yes, I'm not saying Warhol's a hero, but the whole...
Well, those of us who identified with the whole bohemian beatnik sort of desire to find, cultural freedom of thought, were being duped.
It never
duped.
Occurred to you that was a setup.
Yeah.
Well, you look at my chart, on the tiny note chart, you'll see the phases. You got the beatniks, the hippies, the yuppies, and the guppies. Yeah, that's all part of the Android meme. But let's get to that later. But we're so what's your point about bringing up this movie? Is it called Other Voices?
Other People's Lives.
Okay, and what is your point about it?
Well, it's just explicitly confronting of how political governments that want that are basically phony. They're control freaks, and they're not acting in the best interest of the people who live there. The lengths that they go to maintain control.
Right. So you have the East Berliners, the HCE faction, the so-called intelligent security-minded intelligence services, are making sure someone didn't put out a subversive cultural artifact, a book, a play, or manifesto or something.
Something which might ignite a revolution on all the streets.
Maybe a nice...
And they believed that they were doing it in the socialist best interests of the highest good of the highest number of people.
Right. Now, in the West, you've got millions of ideas every 6 months, to the point that where Andy Warhol says everybody be famous for 15 minutes, and then on to the next famous person, and idea and subversion. Now, that happened in pulp culture from the 50s and on. What McClune pointed out is that the revolutionary inspiration that pop culture offered was a big figure, and the real ground was the threat or the real operation. So the hypnotism of rapid innovation, rapid series of innovations as ersatz or fake anti-environments, that's what was not pointed out by Warhol or anybody else other than McClellan. So that the revolutions that the pop culture world you just inventoried seemed to inspire were, we could say, I don't want to say they're delusions, but they are rearview mirror in terms of what was really causing a change in people.
Mm-hmm.
And so all the revolutions of the 60s and 70s all came and went. Not everybody, what is it? Everybody famous for 15 minutes? Every movement was famous for 15 minutes. So the transition, the inspirations in an exploding cultural whirlpool in the West was so intimidating to the Russians, Soviet commissars, that they basically had a Luddite policy of not allowing Elvis or anything to come into a Soviet Union in the 50s and 60s and 70s. And they thought they were preserving, McLuhan would say, literate culture. Meanwhile, literate culture was totally destroyed in the West, and nobody seemed worse for the wear until we got to where we are now. And there's a lot of arguments about what that means. So the revolution that you thought was in Warhol was a speeded-up version that Orwell and Aldous Huxley and maybe even Norm Mailer weren't critiquing accurately.
Yeah.
Only McLuhan was giving the real hidden effects of what was going on.
And I think that was because McLuhan relied on, as you've pointed out many times, Joyce Pound Lewis, and these guys were looking deeper into the cultural history of humanity in such a way that that McLuhan was deriving universal truths, which were more expansive than the kind of cultural pop truths.
Or political truths.
Yeah.
Temporary political truths.
Right.
Now, what's interesting is that, remember, Joyce Lewis and Pound? Pound gets arrested for treason. Lewis is boycotted by the establishment in England. They all had tragic fates. McLuhan was boycotted. You know, that they were really... Warhol wasn't boycotted. He was celebrated.
Yeah.
So when you get...
I didn't know that about McLuhan. About Joyce Pound and Eliot. Were they actually perverse in terms of their allegiance to... say, fascist doctrines and so on and so forth, or were they just simply misunderstood by the culture and persecuted sort of like Jesus was persecuted?
Well, most people would say that they were dupes and idiots and were fascists, but Lewis wasn't. Pound was a little more naive and maybe was a blatant fascist, and he worked for Mussolini in Italy and was arrested after the war and put in jail for treasonous activity and almost executed.
I didn't know Lewis. That. I only found out just recently that Pound and McLuhan actually... were alive at the same time and collaborated on they created a press in which they were publishing material. I didn't know that.
Who?
Pound and McLuhan. they created a press called the Square Dollar Press.
Yes, I mean, the McLuhan didn't do too much with that. That was there was a whole bunch of right-wingers who supported Pound while he was in the St. Elizabeth's Asylum in Washington, D.C.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, when Pound and McLuhan was around, and McLuhan was like Lewis. He worked with all kinds of different people. He didn't have political allegiances, but if he saw something that was attempting to wake up people, he would join them.
Mm-hmm.
So the McLuhan lobbied along with Wyndham Lewis to get Pound released from jail, and it worked.
Mm-hmm.
He got released in the late 50s, and he went back to Italy and started marching around with old fascists from Mussolini's day.
Yeah. Well, I'm surprised that Pound became. It sounds like from what you're saying that Pound became seduced by. Sort of fascist policies, but I'm very surprised because he actually was a very creative and innovative in the world of literature.
Yes, and that was inspired by Lewis. Lewis was the big hidden ground in 1913, 1914.
Pound also published Joyce for the first time, I think. Didn't he publish Doubleters?
Pound, Hugh Kenner, a student of McLuhan, wrote a book called The Pound Era. In 1971 it came out. His thesis that Pound was the great MC who created great possibilities for Lewis, Joyce, and Eliot. And that's true. He did that. But more deeper research found out that Lewis was the guy that was inspiring Pound, and that Lewis did a lot. But Pound was the one who got Lewis's novel Tar published in a poetry magazine, and he also was the one who got Joyce's Portrait of the Artist as a young man serialized in a magazine. Mm-hmm. So Pound did a lot.
And he also writes the Cantos, which is considered to be some of the great literature of all time. he's considered a breakthrough in the world of poetry.
That's right. Now, because they could see being poets and writers, they were involved. The reason the artists were interested in new media of communication, in quotes, media of communication, is because that was threats to their jobs, to their professions. They're the ones who are creating in the literate world of arts and plays and novels and poems and all this stuff and painting, and also on this new media wiped them out. So they're studying the effects of new media for professional reasons almost. Now, most of the Andy time doesn't realize what's going to happen with these media environments. That's going to lead the Android meme. But these guys, these poets, people like what we call the men of 1914, Eliot, Lewis, Pound, and Joyce, were forced to look at the stuff, dealt with it, changed their arts to mirror it or to counter the effects to the, to counter the effects that at the time the arts they used to counter these effects were not perceived, and people didn't understand why they were doing this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, now, Pound was became interested... I forget what the original impetus was. One of the artists that he was publishing caused him to take an interest in East-West, and he started studying, I think, Chinese or Japanese language.
Yeah, that's Fenollosa. He started analyzing the Chinese scholar Fenollosa.
Fenollosa.
He adapted the Chinese ideogram to Western poetry because he saw that the ideogram was kind of like the movie effect.
Hmm.
So, of course, people read this, and it had a kind of charisma, but as McLuhan said, I think he quoted T.S. Eliot. T.S. Eliot said, literate culture in Europe and in the teens and 20s last century made up about 3,000 people. All this stuff that students after World War II had to learn was just very tiny. It was an elite culture.
Yeah.
Aristocrats, which LaRouche critiques. We'll get into that later. But the point is it's a very small culture. And when one of these guys published these 3,000 people engaged in new paintings, new arts, when something came out, it was a big event, like a big blockbuster from Hollywood.
Right.
And so, in that limited Gutenberg kind of situation, the smarter of the elites would understand what Pound was doing. A few of them, they'd become critics, or well-known critics. But there was a lot of other critics who thought it was nuts. And so, I mean, Pound, this whole era when Pound was promoting Lewis and Joyce in the teens in London, he writes a poem at the end of the teens called Hugh Moberly that is, maybe another word, maybe three words, but anyways, Moberly, where he writes about his career in the teens in London as a failure. So these guys that are considered great poets, they weren't considered that then.
Yeah.
They did have their supporters, but it was very controversial. And so it's only after World War II that professors like McLuhan and Kenner and other people started to make a big deal out of these people.
What I thought was interesting about Pound, as a bleeding edge as he was for his time, when Joyce started writing Finnegan's Wake, he thought that Joyce had gone over the far edge of the end of the...
Well, that's what's really interesting.
He stopped supporting Joyce.
Oh, yeah, and he goes back to Lewis. You can take any book on the four of them, the men of 1914. There's a few books out. They're very interesting, the alignments, the realignments, the wars. I mean, Lewis, he defected from Joyce and Pound in the 1920s and said they're both stupid, in crude terms. He critiqued them, which then isolated Lewis. But there was a whole bunch of people gathered around Lewis. It's a very complex thing, but actually it's good we're talking about this because these elements are in the tiny note part of the chart that we haven't got to yet.
Right.
Right? The battle between Pound, Joyce, Lewis, and Yeats and Eliot is a level to mime the battle between different media structures.
Right.
And there are really good books. One of the best books is Vincent Sherry, Sherry, who was a student of McLuhan, and now he's a professor. I don't know if he's an American. I don't know if he was an American when he was a student of McLuhan in the 60s or so, but he's a professor. He's been a professor in the States for a long time. His books are really good because he adapts McLuhan's thing but goes back to the intellectual roots of Pound and Lewis in the 19th century and what this obscure information that no one knew in the 50s and 60s.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But what I find interesting in this conversation here is that you as a younger person picked up that Pound was some kind of iconic poem or poet, right?
Mm-hmm.
But you didn't know that he was in jail for treason.
I didn't know that. Yeah.
And you didn't know, and I was telling you before we started taping, that McLuhan suffered the same fate in the 70s. Actual professors in the University of Toronto were trying to get his PhD taken away, which you traditionally, by law, can't do. Once you have your PhD, no one can take it away. But they thought McLuhan was so outrageous, they were trying to get the administration to change the tradition and get rid of his PhD.
Wow.
So if you're actually, you know, talking about the present, hitting a nerve, talking about the present, not the present, P-R-E-S-E-N-T, and hitting a nerve, you're going to get in trouble.
Right.
Lewis really had a tragic time.
Right.
And look at Joyce. I mean, he had a tragic
time. Well, was Lewis, were these guys fascist in any way that was that in you know, historically looking back, we can say, yeah, they definitely were on the wrong side of the track.
We could say that on the surface, Yeats, Lewis, Joyce not so much, but he did say to friends that when Hitler started to make his movies, he said, let him take over. He didn't want to resist him.
Hmm.
And Pound, those four, and Yeats, what did I say? Yeats, Lewis, Eliot, and Pound seemed to support right-wing political movements and parties and were against any of the left-wing movements.
Mm-hmm.
All right. For example, they didn't support the left in the Spanish Civil War in the 30s.
Mm-hmm.
They support the right, Franco and those guys.
Right.
So, but then you look at what they're doing and why they're doing that, and their aesthetic reasons and their technological, intellectual, artistic reasons. It's not that simple. Like Lewis, he's the most cagey. He remember. When he described what he was, he said, I am part communist and part fascist. Remember, I've said this quote before. Part communist, part fascist, and a distinct streak of, what is it, of something in my monarchism. part communist, part fascist, with a distinct streak of Marxism in my monarchism, but at bottom, an anarchist with a healthy passion for order. Totally quadriphenic statement. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Now, he would write for fascist newspapers, but he never went to their political parties. He never got politically involved. All right?
Mm-hmm.
So what he presented is something that scholars have argued over, you know, for decades. And some have said he was a blatant fascist, and some say no, he was talking about media dynamics, which is the position McLuhan takes. They weren't talking in terms of HCE levels on my chart of intelligence factions trying to preserve the status quo. They were, Lewis was perceiving the ALP level, and therefore he was free to relate to anybody because he was trying to wake everybody up.
Mm-hmm.
So it gets pretty tricky.
Yeah.
But yeah, in basic, Don Thiel told me that you can't teach Joyce in academia anymore.
Why is that?
He's considered, I don't know, I never know, found out why, but you, the postmodernists, I don't know, the feminists, or somebody took over. I'm not an academic, so I'm not in touch with this stuff, but Don keeps me track, and Don Thiel is a born 1928, so he's 79-year-old professor, former president of Trent University, McLuhan's first and best PhD student. He, as a professor since the 50s, went through all these changes, and he says that, and he tries to retrieve Joyce and counter Kenner's thesis that it was the Pound Era. Thiel wrote in the 90s a book called The Joyce Era, to say that Joyce was the key.
Hmm.
But he says that he is very unpopular and on the margins because he does that. He has a small coterie of people who appreciate what he's doing, usually Joycean scholars, but in general, it's very risky, like it is to use McLuhan, to talk about Joyce.
Hmm.
Isn't that amazing?
It's risky to talk about McLuhan?
Oh, yeah. You can't use McLuhan in academia.
Huh. Because people are too stupid? I don't get why.
Well, that's what our series is trying to explain why.
Jeez.
Our dialogues, I've been telling you why.
Well, we're going to get to that, I guess. But
well, we've been talking about it for 1,000 hours.
A lot of people think that McLuhan relied mostly on Joyce, and I believed that for a long time. But then you said that the deeper influence was actually Lewis.
Yes, and that's come out in letters that Andrew Crystal found.
Mm.
We knew that. You know, deep McLuhanites knew that. But McLuhan writes about the problem in the 40s to Hugh Kenner. He says, I can't promote Lewis, because Lewis was considered a fascist and is not popular after World War II. It's like writing about, like, supporting Pound. So he said, I will use Lewis's agenda and what I've learned from him, but I'm not going to make it obvious.
Sure.
And then a little later, he writes a letter and says, the heck with it. I'm going to promote Lewis. So
the thing I don't understand is, I can see how Lewis could be a prophet of the electrical age in the 1920s and 30s. But he couldn't be a prophet of the computer age because it hadn't come into manifestation yet. And Marshall was alive during the chip era. So,
that's why he dropped Lewis in the 50s and started promoting Finnegan's Wake.
Mm-hmm.
And I've discussed this with people like Andrew Crystal and Michael Edmonds, and we've talked about how, and Don Thiel, and Don agrees with me, that McLuhan, and you'll see it in my essay on McLuhan, that politically, McLuhan was Wyndham Lewis. But you can't present Lewis's novels and essays as something intriguing in the mid-60s when everybody's on LSD and whacked out and sex, drugs, and rock and roll, especially his students, which he's concerned about. You have to present something to counter the LSD. So he presented the unreadable book, Finnegan's Wake, because that seemed to be complex and interthreaded enough with different media that would have a kind of charisma that simple English prose would not have. So he dumped talking about Lewis in the 60s and emphasized Finnegan's Wake because its textural complexity mimed the actual experiences students were going through in the rock, sex, drug counterculture.
Mm-hmm.
So, but he brings back Lewis later. He writes an article for Atlantic Monthly in December 69 about his life with Lewis, because every now and then there'd be a retrieval among publishers and that kind of interest, rekindle interest in Lewis. So in the late 60s, when there was a rekindle interest, they knew McClone was into Lewis, knew that he actually knew Lewis and had met him. So they got him to write something for Atlantic Monthly. And it's in that that McClone says that he got everything, he owes a huge debt to Lewis. Now, if you've been reading McClone, you know, you're a student or just a citizen, and reading about this guy, talking about the medium as the message and all that, and you might notice, oh, he's quoting Joyce. Then you might think, oh, well, Joyce is a big influence on him. You'd be surprised in 69 to find out Lewis was the key.
Hmm. And Lewis was the key to Joyce as well.
Yes.
In other words, Joyce relied on Lewis for his percepts.
Well, Lewis wrote an amazing play called Enemy of the Stars in 1914. And McClone says that's where he deals with Discarnate Man, way before everybody. And Joyce is working on Ulysses at that time. And when Joyce saw Enemy of the Stars in the publication that Lewis and Pound put out called Blast in 1914, it changed his view of what he was doing with Ulysses. And that the later strange hallucinatory chapter called Circe was designed around the impact of the play Enemy of the Stars.
Mm.
So now there's other scholars that say today Joyce's secretary, Samuel Beckett, the famous 50s and 60s playwright, that he designed his plays on Enemy of the Stars.
Hmm.
So that he was influenced by Beckett, by Lewis, and people didn't know that. So Lewis is, and then you see Pound is very enthusiastic about Lewis for many decades. And Yeats says that Lewis was, he said Lewis was so profound in his books that he wrote, his essay books in the 20s, that he said he was envious of him. And Eliot said that Lewis was the first person in English literature in centuries to create a new form of prose, a new style.
Mm-hmm.
So they really praised Lewis. So
I don't know if Pound got this from Lewis, but I know that Pound, one of the critical views of Pound, and it was embroidered into his cantos, was the idea that poetry should not be an abstraction of thought, but it should be a vivid crystallization of imagery, vivid imagery, and it should be very concrete. That poetic imagery should be very concrete, so that it, you know, you can't not.
Precise was their language.
Yeah.
Precise.
Did he now? Was he?
You know why they felt that?
Why?
Because under the influence of Lewis and what's called ideology, not the political ideology, but the ideologue, French, ideologie, ideologie. Anyway, it's italicized if you read about it. It's in French. Ideology is ideologie. Anyways, it's a tradition of the 19th century that celebrated the eye and was against the mass feeling and against the ear and music, which enhanced the mass feeling. So Lewis and Pound took up this obscure but influential in certain circles intellectual debate going on in Europe in the 1890s and 1900s, and they devoted themselves not to the flux and flow of music, but to the hard crystalline perspective of the eye, the hard image. So their whole aesthetics was based on the eye over the ear and music.
So they were trying to preserve the book in a time when the book was being demolished.
In McClone terms, yes. And so that they said that you needed a strong authoritarian figure who stood out from the hoi polloi and the musical mass merger and represented the individual tradition of the West as a strong, hard image. And that's why Pound went for Mussolini.
Uh-huh.
And why later Lewis went for Hitler.
Wow.
They did it for aesthetic reasons. But most people think they did it for political reasons. And it gets more complex, and the best scholar on that is Vincent Sherry. Vincent Sherry, S-H-E-R-R-Y. His book is called Ezra Pound, Wyndham Lewis, and Radical Modernism. I think that's the title. Very good book. And it goes into this history. And the critics that read it say, hey, Sherry's come up with a whole view that no one knew.
Mm-hmm.
But it came from McLuhan, because he was a student of McLuhan. So we've really gone, we can say we've gone way off in talking about the Dobbs formula chart, but we haven't. This is actually the drama I have embedded in the tiny note chart, because you'll see each quadrant is either Pound, Lewis, Yates, Elliott, or Joyce.
Right? Well, not only that, but on the Bob's formula chart, we're about to ingress into 1900, 1918, 1918, 1945, and so on. So we're kind of laying a groundwork for the next part of the Bob Dobbs formula.
That's right. So we must be near the end of this side.
Yeah, we're ready to take a break.
Okay, good.
So I'll be back with you in a bit.